The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth. In a recent Deep Dive episode, we talked about ways that municipalities use fines and fees to raise revenue. We focused on the sometimes outrageously excessive nature of the fines that IJ's clients and others have gotten for trivial code violations. $30,000 for grass that's too long, $100,000 for parking with the wheels of their car a few inches outside of the driveway, and more. Those numbers are staggering, but one thing they don't capture is the injustice of the systems themselves. So I'm here today with IJ attorneys Diana Simpson and Josh House to continue the discussion of municipal fines and fees, focusing on how those systems can turn into machines that deny people vital constitutional rights. Diana, let's start today by talking about your case in New York, where we have a fines and fees case that doesn't hinge on the size of the fines, but instead really concentrates on the way that system works. What can you tell us about the New York City Department of Buildings?
Right. So the New York City, I think a lot of people think about it in terms of the skyscrapers, which dominate the skyline. But those are only a fraction of the buildings that are in the city. The lion's share of the city's structures are residential. So walk-ups and single-family homes and lofts and brownstones, all sorts of types of houses. And so the Department of Buildings oversees all of this. They oversee the residential, the commercial, everything. And so the department, the DOB, as we call it for short, issues permits, they inspect buildings, oversee construction-related licenses, and enforce the city's construction codes. And, importantly, they impose fines for violations. They do this both for the big developers and ordinary homeowners alike. And these fines can be astronomical. The DOB's mission here is to ensure safety, but it often loses sight of this charge. And so the fines that I mentioned can be up to about $25,000 per violation, which is a lot. And the problem is that it's not just one fine. The DOB turns around and they hit people with multiple fines for the same violation, and they keep coming back with additional violations for failing to comply with the initial violation. So these just pile up at an astonishing pace. And it's not quite as simple as just fixing the problem. You have to first pay all of the fines just to get a permit to fix the problem. And so you end up having these fines that continue to accrue while you're trying to get the permit, but you have to pay the fines first in order to get the permit. And then it very quickly gets out of control and out of grasp of a lot of homeowners. And so this isn't just a theoretical problem. This is something that the DOB does every day. There was one homeowner that we heard about who bought a home that had a renovated garage and bathroom that he thought of as basically a bonus when he bought it. Well, he came to find out that these had been installed by the previous owner without the proper permits that they needed. And so the DOB decided to issue the current homeowner a series of violations and fines. And he did not learn of these violations right away, but he tried to fix it once he heard about it. By then, he couldn't afford the fines, and he couldn't get the permit to fix the problem without first paying for the fines. And so the tickets kept coming, and he now owes $500,000 for work that was done before he even bought the home. And so this system is just rife with abuse. And we filed suit against the DOB on behalf of another homeowner named Joe Corsini, who, while he didn't face quite as high of fines as that, his rights were violated by the DOB nevertheless. So Joe is a pigeon keeper. And for those of you who may wonder why, keeping pigeons is the New York equivalent of having a backyard rabbit hutch in the suburbs. I did ask about this at first because it was a little foreign to me, but it seems that this is a pretty
familiar
common
to
practice.
Every New Yorker, mysterious to those of us from the Midwest.
Exactly. And so Joe's father and grandfather both kept pigeons, and he's just always loved the birds. And so he decided to build a small coop on the roof of his home to kind of accommodate this interest and to really, you know, be something that he could enjoy. But he didn't realize that he needed a building permit just to put up this coop. And so he got it up. He built it by himself. And once it went up, a DOB inspector showed up and issued him $3,000 in fines, accompanied by an order to get a permit for the coop. So he tried. And so he ended up hiring an architect to try to bring the coop into compliance. And they worked together to try to fix the problems that the DOB cited with the DOB. But it seemed each time that they went back and they tried, the DOB raised new requirements and added new things that he had to comply with. Eventually, they said that he had to run a sprinkler system to and then in the coop. And that was just prohibitively expensive, and that seemed to be a step too far. And so at that point, Joe decided that it just wasn't worth it, and so he ended up taking down the coop.
There are so many pieces of that that just make it really clear that this can't be a simple health and safety thing. Like, I mean, a sprinkler system for a pigeon coop is ridiculous. The idea that you can't really set about complying with the repairs until you've paid. I mean, it seems like if they were worried about the health and safety, they would want you to fix it right away and not let you get hung up on these delays because you can't afford to pay their fines.
Absolutely. And the types of fines they assess run from this very serious type of fine that has to be, you know, it's immediately hazardous is how they describe this set. And that's what they hit Joe with for a pigeon coop. And so when I think of immediately hazardous, I think of a crumbling edifice on the outside of a building that can come crashing down into a pedestrian at any moment, not a pigeon coop on someone's roof. That seems to me to be more on the less serious side that the DOB certainly has the authority to enforce against, but perhaps they don't bring in quite as much money that way. And so by the end of it, the DOB had imposed $11,000 in fines on Joe just for building a coop. And dealing with the bureaucracy of trying to get the coop permitted was just a sliver of the procedural nightmare that Joe ended up facing. There were two kinds of tickets that he received. One, there is absolutely no defense, review, or appeals process. The only option that a homeowner has is to just pay the fine that they demand. The other type of ticket, you do have some review in front of an administrative law judge, but it's not great. You can't really get in front of a judge until you're at the appeals process. But in order to appeal, you have to pay the full amount owed once again. And so really, they're just demanding people pay out the nose to get this kind of review. And so you may have heard of a bond before, but this isn't the same thing. Normally, with a bond, you pay a small percentage that you then get back afterward. Here, the city requires the full amount owed. You have to do it within a month of the decision, or you'll never be able to get a judge to review this particular penalty. And of course, appealing adds on additional fees, and an appeal can actually result in greater fines than the initial penalties that the DOB imposed. So it's really, you know, beware if you want to take it up on appeal.
It makes it so risky to try to stand up for yourself because you could just potentially get squashed. Not to mention that even trying to stand up for yourself itself costs a bunch of money. I mean, Joe hired the architect. I think he hired an attorney at one point before IJ got involved. I mean, that's thousands of dollars in professional fees for people who are still kind of flummoxed by the system, even though they're professionals in the city.
Exactly. It's this Byzantine system, and I cannot stress enough how convoluted it is. I mean, when IJ got involved, we have three lawyers staffed on the case internally, one of whom argued at the Supreme Court. It took us an enormous amount of time to understand the system, and we ended up having to include charts in our complaint about how the system works. And so if it's that challenging for lawyers to understand how the law works, what hope does your average Joe, quite literally here, have to understand this? It's just a wild system that really doesn't seem to care who gets wrapped up in it and who just has to pay out the nose to help fund the city.
Well, one question I think that a lot of people would have as they think about this, you mentioned, you know, the Department of Buildings is responsible for the brownstones and the skyscrapers. And so, it seems like, is there a chance that people like Joe are just kind of the collateral damage in pursuit of this really important goal of preventing a skyscraper from collapsing, and that the reason that the fines are that it operates the way that it does is to just hold these big developers accountable and make sure that they're keeping cranes from falling down. The fact that the pigeon coop got the same kind of ticket that one of those cranes get, I mean, like, that seems to count against that. But is there just like the potential that this is unintended consequences?
Maybe originally, but to the contrary here, the city seems to target ordinary homeowners who are less likely to know the process, the secrets for minimizing their costs in the system and how to successfully challenge these violations and how to otherwise protect their rights. So what you end up facing is homeowners just pay more because they're not familiar with the system. And the DOB seems to really want to go after these just individuals to try to get them. And so while many developers end up having staff whose sole job is to handle the DOB, whether it's getting permits and pulling those, getting those ready, whether it's dealing with the violations, you know, people don't have that. And so they're trying to deal with their lives, their jobs, their families, and also deal with the DOB. And it's almost impossible.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the amount of money that comes in. I had seen several numbers that in terms of how much the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, plans to raise. Like, they certainly count on these fines and fees coming in to kind of supplement the city's budget. How does that factor into the way that you assess these systems?
So money is a huge driver here, and I think it would be fair to suggest that it's the main driver by the city. And so New York City raised nearly $1 billion in fines and forfeitures this fiscal year, and that's projected to increase by $150 million next year. Those numbers are just mind-boggling. And it really seems to be that raising revenue is the goal here, and not necessarily just here, but that's certainly one of the big goals here.
So, Josh, because New York is very special in so many ways, it might be easy to think that this is the kind of problem is limited to big cities like that. But you actually have a case in a small town in Georgia where they're only taking in $3 million in fines and fees in a year. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how the revenue, that desire for revenue, plays out in the smaller town, and what it looks like in the system that you're challenging in Georgia.
Sure. And yeah, that's only $3 million out of $12 million. So, you know, it's one of those where it's only $3 million, but it is about a quarter of the revenue of this small town called Doraville, Georgia, which only has a population of about 10,000 people, give or take. And what Doraville has taken to doing is relying on this fines and fees revenue to keep the city afloat. The years we surveyed before filing the case showed that it was anywhere between 17 and 30% of the city's revenue, and that it tended to correspond to revenue shortages that were in the state or in the city. In terms of just their lack of property taxes, they were just making up the difference through the use of fines and fees. And actually, in one instance, they passed a specific fee, a $25 fee that attached to every single court case in Doraville, that would specifically pay for capital improvements and other citywide projects. So at IJ, we've used the term taxation by citation to describe this, and I just don't think there's another way to look at it. This is essentially using the criminal justice system to tax people who go through it.
So in looking at that system, obviously that desire for revenue and the reliance on revenue is similar to what Diana described happening in New York. Are there things that are different there that are important as you look at these systems in deciding whether or not they're unconstitutional or not?
Sure. I mean, what's different in this situation is that, you know, you have a city that is using small fees on a lot of people to try to fund the, like I said, the basic operation of the city. So you can look at the example of Hilda Brucker, who is our client in the case, who we're representing in this challenge to the city's practices. And Hilda was ticketed just $100 for having a cracked driveway. By the way, she also got criminal probation as part of that. And one of the conditions of which is that she has to refrain for 6 months from the consumption of alcohol. So this is a criminal proceeding. This isn't just some sort of, minor administrative zoning board decision. This is a criminal record that our client now has because of a crack in her driveway. But these $100 fees that people like Hilda have to pay, they add up to that $3 million. And, you know, what's unfortunate is that what happens is that these low fees you know, while low at an absolute amount, are huge for the people who often have to pay them. People who are trapped in this municipal court system are often the most marginalized people in these communities, and they don't have legal representation many of the times. And so, you know, they get a $100 fee, but then there's, you know, a probation fee. That's a payment that's added if you need a payment plan, because the payment plan is done by a private probation company, and they get a cut from these fees. That way the city doesn't have to pay them. Of course, you know, it wouldn't pass cost benefit analysis if the city had to spend money collecting this money. So the city allows someone else to do it. So that $100 fee could turn into $140. If you take 1 month to pay it, a $40 monthly probation fee. And those fees can just really snowball. And so what looks like small on an absolute level could be huge. If $100 means, you know, groceries or not, you might not pay that $100, but then you're paying $140. And if you don't pay that, there's more fees and more fees. And so I think, you know, it's important to keep in mind that although these are small from the individual perspective, that they can actually become, because the person's in need or because these fees can snowball, massive obligations for these people to pay. And this is actually, you know, why when you add all these up, they go to funding these cities so substantially. And the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights released a report that named Doraville among the top 10 in cities nationwide that depend on fines and fees to bring in their general revenues. There were a few other cities, some of which IJ actually surveyed in its strategic research on this issue. The study was called Taxation by Citation, and it surveyed three other Georgia cities that were doing similar things. And actually, you know, one of the conclusions from that by surveying these cities is that, you know, it's not just a matter of finances, it's a matter of community trust, that people do not trust their judicial system, their local municipal court, if they think that that system is just in it for money. You know, another unfortunate sort of result of all this is just how normal it becomes to have interactions with either the municipal court or police. And so you see, for example, when it comes to police interactions, what happened in Ferguson, which is really what drew a lot of people's attentions to this, you know, a small municipal violation results in, you know, a young African-American man being shot. And that was just symptomatic of a larger problem that was in Ferguson. And that's because Ferguson needed fines and fees to fund almost, again, a quarter of its revenues. The other issue that pops up is just, you know, this becoming normalized means that, you know, people don't have a sense for what their rights are. Why fight it? Everyone goes to court. Everyone pays these fines. When we at IJ filed a lawsuit in Pagedale, Missouri, which is just down the road from Ferguson, this was one of the most common things that we heard from our clients and from other people in the city, which is, you know, I'll just see so-and-so at court night. You know, of course.
Oh, that's
just
terrible. Yeah, it's like, you know, the bingo game and then go to court to pay your tickets. Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it's just, I'll see my neighbors there. I'll say hello to them there. Everyone's going to go to court. We'll all see each other there anyway. I mean, the way our client described it to us was that the streets would feel sort of empty on those evenings that there was court, because everyone's at court. Wow. And when we would suggest to people that, hey, you know, do you think there's something wrong here? Again, it had become so baked in that no one had thought, hey, maybe my due process rights are being violated. And so I think that's that community trust aspect, as well as the policing aspect, are just two aspects that are really overlooked when you're looking at the effects of these small fines.
So do you think that the fact that, you know, I think one of the most striking examples that you gave is the fact that for our client Hilda, this cracked driveway $100 fine went along with a criminal penalty and probation, which I assume is on her record. And is the reason that the city does that kind of a technical procedural one, or is it because, like, that's how important it is to them to get this money, that they're going to attach criminal penalties to it to just make sure that they really put the screws to people?
I mean, I think it's a little of both. It's a little, you know, just that's sort of how the bureaucracy has been created in Georgia, is that municipal courts have general jurisdiction over any violation of a municipal ordinance. Now, here's what's interesting is that actually they have jurisdiction over low-level state violations as well. But there's an incentive for them to charge you under the local municipal code, because only then does the city get all the money from the fine that it'll impose on you. And so, you know, there's testimony, for example, in our case about how, you know, the prosecutor has the discretion to change a state violation to a local violation, and therefore ensure that the money stays within the city. But the other part is that, you know, keep in mind that On the back end, when it comes to collecting these fines and fees, that probation system, which is a criminal system, is what serves as the collection mechanism. And what that means is that if you don't pay the probation company, you have violated the terms of your probation. And that means you've committed a criminal offense, as anyone who's, you know, been on probation can well attest, that violating probation is not something you want to do. And so you have this situation where I think it's not just that that's how the bureaucracy works in these Georgia municipalities and in many other states' municipalities, but it's also that there's an incentive to use the full force of the criminal justice system to enforce and collect these fines and fees.
So now that we've talked through how the systems actually work and some of the reasons why and why they're so outrageous, let's talk about the legal challenges to them that IJ is bringing. We rely on the 14th Amendment and the assurance that no one will be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And I wondered if we could start by talking about the historical basis for that provision, kind of going, it wouldn't be a deep dive if we didn't talk about Magna Carta or common law. So let's go ahead and start there. Where does that idea of needing to have a proper process before you can take away someone's property or liberty, where does that come from?
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. It does go all the way back to the Magna Carta, 1215, you know, King John signing the document along, you know, with his barons. And in that document, there was the law of the land clause, which I'm sure has come up on a deep dive before. But the basic idea is that, you know, going back to that, and it slowly became what we call due process. But the idea is that you cannot be deprived of your life, your liberty, or your property except through the right processes or except through the law of the land. And that means it's not just some, you know, king or sovereign or other sort of dictator at the top saying, give me your property. What that means is that it has to be through law, through the courts, through the proper processes. Now, at IJ, we bring both substantive due process and procedural due process claims. And the difference there is that substantive due process means that the government cannot do the substantive thing it's trying to do at all. In other words, no amount of process will justify what the government's trying to do. Whereas in procedural due process claims, the government simply didn't follow the right procedures before it did the thing that it did. And so the claimant is saying, hey, you know, maybe you can do this to me, but let's go to court. Let me have my day in court. And, you know, I think in these sort of fines and fees areas where we're making these arguments, it really is a sort of mix of both. You know, because the basic argument here is that when you walk into Doraville's court and you see this judge who is an employee of the city, and you know that he as an employee of the city works, that means he directly reports to the city that depends on your conviction to make money, to keep itself afloat for a quarter or more of its income, you're going to not think that you're getting a fair day in court. You're not getting a fair hearing. Your case is being heard by someone who has this bias or conflict of interest against you. The conflict of interest there, of course, is a judge has an interest to be neutral. And then there's this financial interest, and those are clearly in conflict here. So that's kind of how we make those arguments in these cases. And, you know, frankly, it's a growing area of law. I brought up Ferguson. That's really what has kind of alerted people to some of the violations in this sphere. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has been ruling on these things for almost 100 years now, going back to a case in the Prohibition era called Toomey versus I believe it's Toomey versus Ohio. And then the next one, it was in the 1970s. It was Ward versus the Village of Monroeville, also in Ohio. And in both of these cases, what was at issue was the use of Ohio sort of mayor's courts. And the idea that at least in the second case, the Ward case, the idea that the city was dependent on this money in order to continue running. And so when it's running its local courts, it had to convict people to fund, I think there it was around 30% or a little bit more of the city's revenues. Now, fast forward to today, there are you know, many cases coming out on this topic, applying this to the municipal court issue that, again, came to the forefront after Ferguson. And so, you know, we, for example, in the Doraville case, are citing to another case that came out in the 11th Circuit that involved a private probation company that had a profit incentive. And so the 11th Circuit said that that was unconstitutional, that that profit motive by the private probation company violated due process. There was another case out of the, or two cases out of the 5th Circuit that came out of New Orleans. And in New Orleans, they were, again, they were funding the courts through the fees that were paid by the people appearing before those courts. And so there are a lot of new cases on this, but the principles go way back.
And so, even further back than that, I just want to chime in and add one thing, is that there's this big debate about the scope of substantive due process and whether it should cover all of these kinds of substantive issues, or if the point of due process is really just to cover the processes involved, as the language might suggest. And so we're obviously not going to get into that big debate now, because it's been raging for quite some time. But the 14th Amendment's Privileges or Immunities Clause was originally intended to protect a whole host of rights that people have by virtue of being a U.S. citizen. And so that was perhaps supposed to cover the substantive areas at issue here that we keep talking about. But it was basically eliminated about 5 years after it was, after it came into existence, in a case called the Slaughterhouse Cases. And so for a deep dive into that, the first season of IJ's podcast, Bound by Oath, really kind of addresses all of that. And it's really fantastic. But, for our current purposes, we invoke whatever we can to win on behalf of our clients. And the current case law is that there's this substantive due process and procedural due process areas that you can go down to defend your rights and to push back against the government's imposition of both these fines and these systems and making people go through all of this.
Yeah, and I mentioned that really this case and our fines and fees work generally is a mix of both, right? Because it is both that you're not getting a fair process when you show up to a court that has a bias against you, and you're also the government also just substantively never has the power to make a profit, to use the criminal justice system to profit rather than for a public purpose, which is health, safety, and so forth.
So I wanted to use the example of Doraville relying on a quarter of its budget coming from these fines and fees. If that's a key part of our case, and I think it is that substantive, a substantive problem where you're just saying, look, just by definition, for all of the reasons you described, this leads to perverse incentives. It means that you don't have a neutral judge because they're being funded. If that's true, what kind of evidence do you rely on to make that case? Is there a number where courts have said, okay, if it's more than 25%, then that's a substantive process. If it's less than that, well, then that just all comes out in the wash. Or how do you choose those arguments? And then once you do, how do you put the evidence together to persuade the court that it is a violation?
Yeah, well, so the test that's used here is this two-part test. So just at the beginning, first, the conflict of interest exists even if the amount of money is very small, even if the judge or the city is only getting a small amount of money. The reason that the amount of money matters is not just because it kind of shows us that there's a problem, right, that the city is so dependent on the fines and fees, but also because the Supreme Court has said that if it's de minimis, if it's a small amount of money, if it's not enough, that would make the average city or judge or whoever's doing the adjudicating actually change their decisions, then you can kind of ignore it. And so, you know, what we will do is, one, we'll try to show that there is a conflict. And, you know, here, not only is there a conflict because the money that you get fined in Doraville goes straight into the general fund that pays the judge's salary, not only is there a conflict because it's clear that the city depends on the fines and fees, the way it budgets means that it has to raise fines and fees or else it would all of a sudden lose substantial amounts of its income. But then there's also that substantiality element, or the non-de minimis part, which is, you know, the numbers are staggering. It's $3 million. It's, you know, anywhere around, you know, 24% more or less of its revenue. So both of those have to be met. And the sorts of evidence would be, for example, budgeting figures. I mentioned earlier that there's this, you know, city council debates that actually show that a $25 fee was added to every single case specifically for funding the city generally. And in fact, when they were low on code enforcement officers one year, they wanted to start some sort of focused code enforcement program. They actually considered raising it to $37. So they're not raising taxes. They're not doing the normal sort of way of raising revenue, and they're not cutting spending, surprise, surprise. So what do they do instead? They're putting the cost on people in the criminal justice system. And so pieces of evidence like that are the sort that we're putting forth for the court to see. Now, in our case, the trial judge decided against us. And the reason that he did so was that he sort of misunderstood some of the facts that were relevant. He focused on the judge in particular as a person. There's a lot of testimony in the record in our case that said, you know, the judge, you know, for those of you who are familiar with the old sitcom Hogan's Heroes, and you remember Sergeant Schultz, you know, would see the POWs clearly planning an escape. And, you know, he would be like, I see nothing. I know nothing. I don't want to get involved. That's kind of what the judge's testimony was in our case. He just said, I have no idea. The city gets money. It gets money from these. I had no idea. I had no idea that this is how it works.
And therefore it couldn't have influenced me, right?
It couldn't have influenced me. In fact, one of the facts was that he claimed to not even know the terms of his own employment. I don't know. Can they fire me? Can't they fire? I have no idea. Well, the judge in our case sort of credited that and said, look, how could it be possible that the judge is biased if he has no idea what's going on? And what we said is, look, that's just the wrong analysis. And if you look at, for example, the private probation case that I brought up earlier that just got handed down in the 11th Circuit, which covers Georgia, you know, the court in that case didn't parse whether the particular probation officers hired by the company are, you know, how much of the finances did they know? Did they know what was happening? Did they know what was going on? How much money ended up in their pockets? They just said, look, they're at-will employees of this company. I mean, to be honest, they didn't even say that. They just kind of presumed that, of course, the employee of a company is going to be acting for that company's interest. And I think that's just the analysis that should be here, right? The judge can be, you know, we have evidence in the record showing that the judge, his contract has expired under Georgia law. That means he can be fired at any time. You know, they admitted actually under the formal rule where they can admit facts, they actually admitted that the judge can be removed for any reason. There's no legal impediment to them getting rid of this judge. And so really, I think the analysis should stop there. You know, Doraville has this massive profit incentive to convict people, and it can't avoid the due process constraints on that by simply hiring somebody else to violate someone's due process rights. You don't avoid a due process problem by saying, well, it's not me, it's this guy I pay so much an hour that does it. That doesn't fly. And the court said that in the private probation case, and we're expecting the 11th Circuit to say the same in our case.
As you described the analysis there and in like the fact that the judge's sort of purported ignorance played such a big role, I couldn't help but be kind of angry because, you know, in New York, I know that the fact that the homeowners know nothing about, you know, that everybody is so mystified by the process, they're mystified by how to go about correcting it, like that idea of this is also complicated and I don't know, it turns out to be a free pass for the government, but it doesn't matter if you're the property owner who now owes $500,000. Well, you should have just known. You know, it's just crazy.
It is. And that unfortunately seems to be the way it is in a number of areas of the law. That's true under the Fourth Amendment. The government kind of police officers tend to get a free pass for not understanding the most current trends of the law where, you know, regular citizens are presumed to know everything that's illegal at any given moment. And it's nuts. And that's not the way that the presumption should exist. The presumption, I think, should always be in favor of liberty and should not be in favor of the government like this. But unfortunately, that tends to be what we're facing.
So we're up on appeal in Doraville. We're still waiting for the first round of decisions in New York. What would, you know, when we prevail, what would a victory look like? These systems, let's say that that we acknowledge that there is an appropriate use of municipal fines, that there are instances where it does make sense to have these, but we want to make sure that they're done right. What would a constitutional system look like? And is there a way that winning in these cases, how does it move the law in that direction?
And fines and fees, of course, are going to exist, at least in most kind of conceptions of the criminal justice system. We're not saying that fines and fees can never be charged. And at least in Doraville, the exact relief that we're asking for is for the court to say the city can't rely on it. If fines and fees come in and they're extra, fine. That's great. But the way the budget, and in Georgia, you need a balanced budget, as in most states, you know, in the way that these cities budget is that if they didn't have these large amounts of fines and fees, that they would be running a deficit. And that's, they're not allowed to do that. And so there's this incentive to ticket, convict, and fine in order to balance the budget. And what we're saying is remove that incentive. Let's move to a system where when you get to court, you no longer have to question, is this happening to me because they need the money, or is this happening to me because I actually, you know, broke the law? That shouldn't have to enter into your calculus when you enter these municipal courts.
Absolutely. And that's the case, I think, both in small cities and huge cities like New York. And so, you know, to the extent that the city needs more money to operate this massive behemoth of a city, then, you know, don't turn to fines and fees for that. Turn to an equitable taxation system. And of course, nobody ever wants to be accused of increasing taxes. But that is a much more equitable system that is applied even-handedly. And, you know, you don't end up with situations where someone is facing a system that is really designed to just squeeze as much money out of the residents as possible, that's just not the role that government should be playing.
And it's not just revenue too. It's, you know, it's also that we're expecting the criminal justice system to simply do too much in these people's lives. So not only is this sort of a revenue problem, this is an over-criminalization problem. Every single thing, you know, in life is coming under the ambit of the criminal justice system. And what that's doing is it's forcing police officers to go from policing public health and safety to becoming tax collectors. It's forcing these, you know, small cities, or at least giving them a large financial incentive to focus their resources on, you know, convicting small ticky-tack violations like a crack in a driveway, improperly stacked wood logs, which was another claim against one of our clients in Doraville. The reason that these cities are doing this is that these criminal justice systems kind of are reaching into all areas of life. And so, you know, not only is being more fiscally sort of prudent, as Diana was mentioning, wise, but it's also important to just not pass as many laws. Maybe the government doesn't need to regulate the exact, you know, that I need to stack my wooden backyard firewood logs in 4x4x8 sections. Maybe 6x8x4 is okay too. And I think that, you know, that this is something deep dive listeners and viewers are probably familiar with, but over-criminalization is very much the culprit here.
Well, thank you both for taking the time to talk through this, and to everyone for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to hear more like it, you can find more episodes of Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. And don't forget to subscribe.